Aaron Banks is an interesting person, to put it mildly. He is the man who's been credited with creating Brexit, or certainly funding Brexit. He's also very close to Nigel Farage, who is who runs now the most popular party in the UK, according to the latest YouGov research. The Reform Party is bigger in the public's perceptions today, or more popular today, than the Labour Party. The implications are just enormous. Aaron has a strong South African connection, and we're going to be picking up with him how South Africa's recent engagement with the United States might play out into the future. Aaron, really good to have you with us. Given your relationship with so many of these key players now on the global stage, but let's start with your own South African connection, your background here. Reading through a very long New Yorker article about you, it very clearly says that you grew up in South Africa. So where exactly, and did you even go to school here?
Yes, I mean, the article wasn't exactly complimentary. But yeah, my father was in Swaziland for many years, and all over Africa. So he had a house in Umhlanga, Umhlanga Rocks, and we spent a lot of our childhood in Durban and KZN. And I went to school in England, hence the English accent. But they were both English, my parents, so a strong South African connection, but I'm not obviously South African.
And did you go to school here at any time, or was it
always in the UK? No, I went to school in England, yeah. That's right. I generally spent the holidays in SA or somewhere in Africa, wherever my father was. He ran sugar estates and was very active all over Africa.
And your entrepreneurial journey is interesting as well. You didn't go to university, and you then went straight into the University of Life, door-to-door salesman, first job, and from there progressed into what? Where did you make your...
My first job was in Lloyd's. It was in Lloyd's of London, underwriting insurance. And then I went on to form a direct insurance company. That got sold to an American company. And then I've subsequently done it three other times. So it's mainly insurance is where I made the money.
As a serial entrepreneur?
I think you could amend the title serial entrepreneur. I've set up more companies than I've forgotten, I think.
What about, just digressing slightly, Doe Steyn? Did you ever meet the late Doe Steyn? He passed away recently.
Do you know what I did? I actually worked for Budget as a consultant when they first started in the UK. In this country, it was known as Auto and General, and Budget, I think, as well. He's actually credited with a funny story that the ad agency, there's a company in the UK called Compare the Market, and he couldn't pronounce Compare the Market. He'd say Compare the Meerkat almost in Afrikaans, and that's why they chose to use the meerkat as their kind of mascot for their advertising. It came about because his Afrikaans was very strong and his English was quite poor.
Iconic symbol there, almost like the gecko is the symbol for Warren Buffett's insurance company in the United States.
Exactly. Well, I think he called it meerkats. Compare the meerkats. You know. That's why it came about.
Okay, fascinating. Just back to your other involvement and relationship with South Africa before we go into the events of the moment. You have diamond mines in this region. Can you tell us more about them?
Yeah, well, they required some old diamond mines that were part of the Beers diamond mines originally some time ago. It had all ended in a fairly nasty fraud case with a guy called Chris Kimber that's actually live and going through the courts at the moment. So South African courts are proving to world-class in delay. It's taken something like 6 or 7 years to go from the actual allegation to charge him to, I think the court date's sometime in June now. Quite astonishing, actually.
And this Chris Kimber guy, What is your allegation against him?
Well, the allegation's fraud, essentially misappropriated about 150 million rand of company funds and spent it on school fees, personal expenditure. And then when it came to light, obviously we approached the police. He was charged with fraud. But, you know, it's really interesting, actually. Ramaphosa comes to London and talks about the crackdown on fraud and how it's essential for South Africa, you know, for international business people to have confidence in South Africa. But the legal system is designed to let the criminals off. I mean, this case has been delayed 9 times. And I think it's astonishing the way that they operate through the lawyers, because there's more and more questions, more and more delays, and the courts really just aren't set up to deal with this kind of level of frustration, if that's the right description.
Yeah, the legal system is held up on a pedestal in South Africa, but the realities of dealing with it, I have from personal experience as well, it just drags on and on. And the only people who seem to get any benefit are the lawyers. And it does appear in your side. But why are you persevering with this?
Well, I just don't approve of this kind of behavior. And I think unless it's called out and you actually are prepared to proceed against someone like this, you know, they just keep doing it over and over again. But I mean, in terms of South Africa, if they want to get direct foreign investment, they need to be able to, you know, prosecute this sort of thing. And I mean, the cases have 3 different prosecutors. You know, it goes on and on and on. And it's just delay, delay, delay. We've got the same lawyers as Gupta, I think, and they're world class at this. Delaying the case, bits of cases go missing. It never reaches a fruition. I suppose the one entertaining. Oh, go on.
We have a term for it in South Africa called the Stalingrad tactic in the law.
Well, I think this case, if in those terms, is probably Stalingrad 1943. It's finally getting to the end of the road, but not without a horrendous fight along the way. I was going to say the one sort of entertaining moment in the case is when someone sent me a video of Chris Kimber. He's charged for fraud in Wembley Port and is actually flying to the Rugby World Cup with the press and appeared in his box with him. And this probably shows the whole issue. I don't think any other country in the world, who are a president of the country meeting the French president, actually do it in the company of someone that's been chopped with cripple down in Wembley. It's hard to imagine. Huh?
Just repeat that, Aaron. You're saying that this Chris Kimber guy, who is defending himself against a 150 million rand fraud case that you continue to pursue, even though it's very unlikely you're going to get the money back, he flew to the Rugby World Cup in Paris with Cyril Ramaphosa?
Yes. I don't know if he flew there, but he certainly appeared in the box at the Rugby World Cup. We've been told he did fly there. But, you know, that bit of it, I don't know. But he definitely appeared with the president in the box at the FIFA World Cup final with Macron. And actually was videoed leaving the tournament together, you know, deep in conversation. And you have to say to yourself, where else in the world would a president of the country be actually seen with someone that is defending themselves on fraud charges and have been charged in a big fraud case? It's hard to imagine.
Wow. So Paula might have more to it than what people are saying, yeah?
Yeah, but as to getting the money back, I'm actually quite confident. One of the policemen dealing with it said that this guy had actually acquired a private jet from, what was the big fraud case? Steinmetz, is it? I forget which one it is.
Steinhoff, yeah,
Steinhoff. He'd actually acquired his personal jet, and it was parked somewhere in the Winelands Airport. So we're hateful of the. If he does lose, he will have to cough up the jet. Maybe I'll buy that.
What a strange world. So this Kimber guy bought Marcus Huster's private jet, which is parked in the Winelands. And then off he goes to the Rugby World Cup with Cyril Ramaphosa, the president. Yeah, I guess, look, there's
on one level, it makes you smile, doesn't it? I mean, it's, you know, 6 or 7 years into the cage, wonderful. Will it ever see the light of day? But, you know, I think you've got to persevere with these sorts of things because otherwise, you know, other people will try to take advantage of you.
You are a perseverer and you do get involved. And I'm sure you've had quite a lot of personal sacrifices as a consequence. But let's go to the reason why you're famous, why so many people know you. And that is you were the biggest funder in UK political history and you funded Brexit or the campaign for Brexit. How did you get involved there in the first instance?
Well, my history with it goes back a long way. 1993, I left the Conservative Party over the Maastricht Treaty. And I always believed that the UK was bigger than the European Union. And really, you know, we should make our own independent decisions. So it wasn't a sort of spur of the moment, sort of irrational decision. It was a long held belief that, you know, the UK would do better outside the EU. And I never thought at the time it would lead on to such an interesting set of circumstances. You know, Nigel and I, after Brexit, left for America. We got involved with the Trump campaign. Nigel spoke at one of the rallies. And the rest is kind of history. So, and then I think it was while even Nigel himself never believed that the betrayal of Brexit would be so great that you'd have to start a political party and then come back into politics. So, you know, I feel a bit sorry for them. Instead of start three political parties, and there's actually won two national elections, which, you know, this takes some doing.
Nigel being Nigel Farage, he has been portrayed by part of the media, I would say legacy media, as a rabid right-winger, anti-European, anti-migration into the UK. You clearly see something different in him.
Well, I think we're reaching a point where normal views are right wing, you know, defending the borders. As we've seen with Trump, you know, 52% of the US population agreed with him. And actually, the left have gone so far left that what were once normal opinions are now deemed to be sort of, you know, rabid right wing opinions, as you saw. But it's telling, really, that, you know, the Conservative Party in third place of below 20%, and Nigel's getting traction in the polls in a way which no one could ever have believed.
And let's dwell a little on that, the YouGov research. Perhaps you could explain how that works and what the latest results were. You've said that Nigel Farage is leading the pack. Just explain that to us.
Yeah, so effectively you've got a series of polls, and they're coming out much more regularly in South Africa. It's almost daily. And they bounce around a bit. I mean, the latest ones have actually shown us in the lead with us sort of 26, 27%, Labour on 26, and the Conservatives down at 20. So now one poll, we're 6 cleared points ahead of the Conservative Party, which used to be the natural part of government, if that's the right description. I think it's become a three-way race, really. But I think the Conservative Party, after 14 years in power, you know, really they're bereft of ideas of what to do. The Labour Party inherited a disastrous situation, fiscally, at a whole different level, and they're just making it work. So it's actually quite fertile territory for reform at the moment. I mean, the whole system needs reform. I never really liked the name at first, but now it's beginning to grow on me.
And you say us? What is your involvement with reform?
Well, I've been a close ally of Nigel for a long time. I actually will be getting more actively involved over the next few months. So I tend to come out to Cape Town between December and February for obvious reasons. My son plays cricket down at Rondebosch Cricket Club. So we generally have the winter out in South Africa, and then go back home. So I'm definitely going to be getting much more involved.
Well, there's certainly worse places to be spending the English winter than in Cape Town. But
it's glorious.
Given your, given your relationship with Nigel Farage, and clearly you have met Donald Trump?
Yes, yes. We were, in fact, after we got elected the first time round, Nigel and I were the first people to actually meet him directly after the election. So Nigel remained, you know, keeps a very close relationship with Nigel. And we know most of the people in the administration one way or the other, which I think is going to be very interesting for South Africa. There's a lot of change ahead now. Yeah.
I really believe, I'm sure that many South Africans are going to be fascinated by your inputs on that. But before we go there, Elon Musk's proposal to fund reform, and he was talking about far more money than has ever been invested in the UK political environment before. I think the number was £100 million or something. What was the story there? Because it was on then he appeared to have a spat with Nigel Farage and it seems off.
I think Nigel's a very strong leader, and I think the row was over a guy called Tommy Robinson, which was an outspoken activist over sort of Muslim rape gang issue he'd had in the UK. And I think Nigel's point was that reform is a political force, and there was no place for Tommy Robinson within the party. And Elon Musk had very strident views on this, and Nigel just told him he was wrong. So I actually quite liked it, and he's risen in the polls since then. But he may be the world's richest man, he may be a clever guy, but doesn't mean he can't be wrong on occasions. So I think it was good that Nigel, you know, set him straight, really. But as to the 100 million, I think that was a bit of a fabricated press story. I mean, the fact of the matter is that reform, if I give you some idea of this, since December, the party membership has doubled from nearly 100,000 to 200,000 in under 8 weeks. So the money's rolling through the door from ordinary people. The Conservative Party membership, for your listeners, was around 130,000. So we overtook it during Christmas and doubled the numbers in the space of 8 weeks. So it's a phenomenon.
And the next election, the next time you'll
next
be able
election
to...
is 2029, so it's a long way off. But there's some big elections along the way, particularly the Welsh election, where there's a devolved parliament, and we're leading the polls in Wales, even better than national opinion polls. And that one's next year. So that will be the first big electoral test for Nigel.
Is there anything you can do as the Reform Party to force an election sooner than 2029?
No. I mean, there's a massive parliamentary majority for Labour. I think these things happen in their own good time. You know, the public needs to be reminded of what socialism's really all about. I feel a little bit sorry for the Labour Party in the sense they inherited a disaster from the Conservative Party, and they're just making it worse. We're probably going to have a big recession in the UK, and I think the time will be right for Nigel in 2029. I mean, there's a series of big elections coming up. I mean, Marine Le Pen in France, I think, is 2027, and that's going to shake the foundations of the EU to the core. So politics has never been more interesting.
Yeah, and how? You said earlier that Elon Musk was wrong about reform. Is he wrong about South Africa? You know South Africa. You've just told us about your childhood. You clearly spend a lot of time here. Yeah. How are you reading the Elon Musk, Donald Trump attack, as has been perceived by some?
I think you've got to split it into two parts. I think if we take Trump first, I genuinely think he's going to try to realign the geopolitics of the whole world. And I think the weakness in US leadership led to BRICS and led to this kind of China-Russia type alliance. So if you want my opinion, I think what will happen is he'll try to wrap up the Ukraine war very quickly, probably within the next month or two with some sort of territorial compromise. The war will end. And I think he'll try to bring Russia back towards the West rather than pushing them towards China. And I think the Americans, Trump in particular, sees China as the real enemy. That's the one that has to be confronted. Because economically, China is strong. Russia is weak economically. It's not a first world power. So I think that's what he's going to try and do. And I think Africa will be at the white heat of this kind of geopolitical realignment, which makes South Africa's position very interesting. Because I think he's going to really take the BRICS thing on head on. And I think the ANC have got real problems with their kind of Iranian connections, all the bad things they've done over the years. It's all going to come chipping up. I think the Americans are going to go full guns blazing to kick the Chinese out of Africa, for want of a better description, and bring the Russians back inside and realign geopolitically. So I think to South Africa, it sits right in the middle of this. It's definitely interesting.
You mentioned Iranian connections. What do you understand by that, and why is that so important to the Americans?
I think Iran's going to be enemy number one. And I think the ANC keep racing through the various other things. So they've been dabbling with, you know, things they shouldn't have been dabbling with. I think that's going to be a very problematic thing here. The Americans are back and they're robust and they're looking to take issues on there. I think they view the whole west coast of Africa as strategically important. It'll be interesting to see the alignment. I think there's only one politician actually in South Africa at the moment really gets it. It's probably Gaetan McKenzie, who's an interesting character. But, you know, you can see actually as well that he's probably the only one that's actually saying, let's engage with the Americans. Let's see what's what.
He could be the Nigel Farage of South Africa, perhaps?
I think he's got the potential to be the president of South Africa. And as we know, politics moves very quickly. You know, I mean, if you look at reform, we've gone from 13% at the general election, we've doubled our support in the space of 6 to 8 months. It's astonishing the speed at which politics changes. But I think that'll be the real issue around South Africa is, you know, the ANC, I think what is disappointing for me is the DA in government seem to have been completely subdued and, you know, fought to heel. Whilst the government of national unity isn't a bad thing, it does seem to be just pursuing the same sort of policies as before.
When you have a look at the future for South Africa, I had a chat earlier this week with a political scientist, Dr. Franz Cronier, who says that unless South Africa wants to avoid the balkanization, i.e. splitting up, it better change its ways very quickly. Now, you have great experience on balkanization to a degree, I suppose, in the way that the UK left Brexit. There are people now being emboldened by the idea that the Western Cape, for instance, could split away from the rest of South Africa. There are people in KwaZulu-Natal who feel the same way. And France says South Africa is a very young country. It only goes back to 1910 or 115 years. What's your take on his warning there or projection?
I mean, it is an artificial country in one way, isn't it, South Africa, if you look at the history of how it was put together. And the Western Cape stands alone in terms of it's the bit of South Africa that really works and would be a leading light for how you do these things. I mean, I can see there's an argument to almost split KZN off, almost as ungovernable, really. But yeah, why not? All things are possible, eh? I think just to finish off on the Elon Musk thing, so that was the Trump worldview. I think Elon Musk, it's slightly more nuanced than that, isn't it? I mean, I may be wrong about this, but 70% of the land is still owned by the whites, so I don't think what he's been saying is entirely true, where the trend towards what they're talking about is a worrying one. Because if you undermine fundamental property rights, you make the country uninvestable. So that's the biggest, you know, the biggest issue to me. I often think as well that if you're being even handed about it, these farm killings are more to do with burglary and robbery and cash than probably having a political aspect to it, you know, remote farm, cash to poll workers, it probably is as much about the cash than it being political, although the lemon kind of made it political. But I don't know. I think it's nuanced.
There are a number of issues there. On the one hand, I remember very well that Jacob Zuma was called out for his allegedly corrupt relationship with Shabir Sheikh years ago, and that was repeated ad nauseum. And that wasn't true. It was a allegation by one of the legal parties. And the people now who are saying, but hang on, this 70%, it just can't be true, because the Nongoma Trust, for instance, in KZN, has got more than half of KZN. So I would like to see a precise number on what is actually owned by white farmers. But anyway.
But essentially, if you go back to the independence, when it became, 94, wasn't it? I'm just struggling to remember the date.
1994.
Four, yeah. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the deal done was that property rights would be kept. Would be a two-thirds majority of the constitution change it. And then it obviously ceded back political power. But I think actually the whites did a deal that was probably quite stronger than the other side realized at the time, because they enshrined property rights, which meant that they kept their properties and businesses. I mean, I often think you get the law of unintended consequences. So when you've cut white people out of government or the police or the army or all the jobs. If you're a white guy in the 20s, the only thing you can become is an entrepreneur. So actually, it's unleashed white entrepreneurism in a way that is probably not the intended consequence. But, so you actually sometimes end up trying to do something but getting totally different results to the one you wanted.
I really would like to know your take on the ANC today, this morning, double down on its attack against Donald Trump. It's not going to, according to the foreign minister, it's not going to, or there's no chance of it withdrawing from the ICJ case against Israel, which Trump has made an issue. And it's also disavowed any relationship on nuclear with Iran, saying that there is no nuclear partnership with Iran whatsoever. How do you see, and I'm putting you on the spot, but you do know the man, the reaction from the White House?
I think you know the answer to that as well as I do. That they're going to use their full economic might to bring people to heel. And I think that includes, the ANC have not got a leg to stand on when it comes to sort of like ICJ or human rights or anything else. It seems a ludicrous thing that South Africa is getting involved in this in the first place, would be my personal thought, International Court of Justice. But the ANC is, it's not very popular. We know it's dropped below 50% in the country, and it's on a one-way trip, hell in a handcart, downwards. And my feeling is they'll use their economic leverage to get the realignment of the world geopolitical situation they want. And nobody's going to stop them.
And South Africa,
so it's going to be interesting.
In the crosshairs there. Aaron, I'm not sure if you followed the 1985 issues, where effectively the United States pulled the rug out of South Africa. We had the debt standstill after the Rubicon speech, and there was interest rates of 25%, companies that thousands of companies that folded as a consequence. And that brought about, hastened the end of apartheid. Some observers here, some very canny observers, are saying we risk a similar consequence. Is that exaggeration?
I don't think it's an exaggeration. I think the South African economy is it's going to be buffeted if America really makes things difficult, and they can be. And I don't think that's the way to go. But I think Gayton's approach is the right way. I listened to him, on an interview the other day. Engage with Trump, over these issues. I'm not even sure domestically, you know, the ANC are going to get popularity points for what they're doing anyway. So should be engaging with the US.
Aaron Banks, entrepreneur and very, very well known in the UK and pretty knowledgeable about South Africa given his background here. And I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.